something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My whole life, I've been told this one story about my family, about how my great-great-grandmother was killed by the mafia back in Sicily. I was never sure if it was true, so I decided to find out. And even though my Uncle Jimmy told me I'd only be making the vendetta worse, I'm going to Sicily anyway. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name is Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today it's that old anthology feeling once again. Rob, I know you're a horror anthology man. What is it about you that makes you gravitate towards the anthology?
Well, I mean, you're talking about two different things, of course, when you're talking about horror anthologies on TV and those in the film, because on TVs, it's a different story every week. And with anthology films, like the one we're going to be talking about today, you, instead of getting one complete film, you get like three or four shorter pieces that are stitched together and been presented to you. So I guess maybe part of it is just out of love for creepy short stories, and the fact that short stories don't have to obey the same rules as novels, and therefore, and also short films don't have to obey the same rules as complete films. I guess it's also nice that they're only going to feel so long. They're going to get to the point. They can only be so drawn out, and it's also like a little sampler box. Like if an anthology film is coming at you, and you know it's going to present you with say 3 to 4 tales, well, you can figure there's going to be maybe one dud in the bunch, but at the very least, you'll have one that's pretty good, right? There's got to be like one central pillar holding up the roof of the thing.
Well, another way I would come at it is that even if they're all bad, it's more fun to have bad variety than bad monotony.
Yeah, I would say so. Like you're into the badness, and then you're out again, and then you're into some fresh badness.
Yeah. I think I would really come back to what you were saying about the comparison to the lengths of horror fiction. This came up in a recent episode where we were talking, I think it was in The Thing from Another World, where we were talking about how it's hard to survey to be sure about this, but my feeling is that horror novels tend to gravitate more towards some semblance of a, quote, happy ending, maybe not happy, but some way in which the protagonist is at least partially victorious or escapes or something. Whereas horror short stories tend more toward bleak and cruel endings, or endings that are really a mean and ironic twist of fate. And obviously, I think there are a lot of reasons why people who enjoy horror fiction are drawn to endings of that sort, but they're harder to pull off on, at the end of a really long narrative where you're more invested with the characters, you've spent more time with them, and it hurts more to see them just sort of like ruined at the end.
Yeah, and I think another thing that you certainly see in short fiction is that sometimes short fiction exists in a space where it doesn't have to concern itself with the ins and outs of a complex plot or some sort of fantastic character arc. You know, our characters don't have to evolve and change and learn lessons about themselves. It can be more about trotting out an interesting idea, or in the case of horror, just a fun monster or some diabolical scenario, that sort of thing.
Right. I think you're correct. I think that the horror genre especially really does lend itself well to the anthology format. I mean, there are plenty of movies that are not horror that you could argue are in one way or another anthology films of a sort. I think one thing I've read is that Pulp Fiction was actually, the concept for Pulp Fiction was partially inspired by the movie that we're going to talk about today. Of course, Pulp Fiction is not horror, but today's movie is. Today's selection for Weird House Cinema is the Mario Bava 1963 Italian anthology horror series Black Sabbath, or in Italian it's called I Tre Volti della Paura. I had to look up what that means. It means The Three Faces of Fear.
Which is a more accurate title, because if you're checking out Black Sabbath expecting witchcraft and the Satan worshippers dancing around a fire or some sort of like pagan ordeal or something going on, you're going to be disappointed, because there is no actual Black Sabbath, real or imagined, in this picture.
No, I would say the closest we come to that, it still doesn't really get there, but that there's sort of that vibe in the middle segment of this movie, and by far my favorite, the Wordulac, which is... I think just an absolutely tremendous segment, and I can't wait to talk about it. But at least the other two really don't have anything to do with that at all.
Now, another interesting thing about the title for this film is that this is said to be where the band Black Sabbath got their name.
Oh, yeah. And I think I could be wrong about this, but I remember hearing it's not even from them necessarily seeing the movie. I think it was like they walked past a movie theater and this was on the marquee and they're like, right.
Yeah. I think there's another version of the tale, and I don't know how much this sounds almost too perfect. So it sounds like maybe it was embellished, but I read a version where they were playing at a theater and then across the street, Black Sabbath was playing, and the line was far longer to get in to see the movie as opposed to getting in to see them play. And they're like, what we need to do is change our name. We need to be Black Sabbath, and then the people will line up for us.
It's like when Patty and Selma proposed changing the name of Springfield to Seinfeld. You just look at what's popular now and try to leech off that.
Yeah, so I don't know which of those stories is true and to what extent, but certainly it's hard to imagine the band Black Sabbath without the name Black Sabbath, because the theme runs so deep through all of their music.
They were called Black Sabbath, they were called Earth. That was not very convenient, because I think there was another band at the time in that area called Earth.
It has a different taste on the tongue initially. Yeah, if you're thinking about going to hear Earth, you have totally different expectations versus Black Sabbath.
Well, as a huge fan of at least the first six Black Sabbath albums, I don't really get into the Dio years very much, but the first six Sabbath albums, I think they're a megalith. You know, they're mm-hmm. like one of those stone monuments from the ancient world, and it's really hard to get under them. But I can't imagine how I would feel about them if they weren't by a band called Black Sabbath. That's so wrapped up in the feeling.
Yeah, can you imagine Nativity in Black by Earth? You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
War Pigs by Earth.
However, I could propose an alternative, which is that if they wanted to drill in and get to the heart of what makes Mario Bava's Black Sabbath really great, they could have changed the name of their band to The Wordulax.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a fun name for a band.
And it would imply that they've been in the mountains for 5 days and come back in a state of God knows what.
All right, well, let's go ahead and give everyone a taste of the trailer on this one, because this is a pretty good trailer. I love the narration here.
Do you believe in ghosts?
This is the night when fear and horror walk hand in hand.
This is Black Sabbath.
Starring the incomparable Boris Karloff, the personable Mark Damon, and lush and lovely women. Even though one is from the netherworld, a vampire, a Vordalak. Black Sabbath, as ancient as superstition, as modern as the telephone.
So it's obvious from the trailer, but I don't think we mentioned that this movie has Boris Karloff in multiple capacities. So he is not only the star of one of the three segments in the anthology, but he's also sort of the pitch man. He is the company spokesperson at the beginning and end of the film.
And of course, this is perfect because in later years, he also served as a horror host on television shows such as Thriller and Out of This World. As I think we've often driven home, though, like there's such a wealth of TV horror anthologies out there. So, for instance, if you just glance at listings for Boris Karloff's Thriller, you'll see, oh, it only went two seasons. But it went two seasons in the 1960s. So those two seasons consist of 67 episodes.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And man, I thought it was long seasons. When you go back and watch a show from the 90s or something where there's like 20 episodes in a season, that seems like a huge amount, but wow.
Yeah. Now, to be clear, Thriller aired 60 through 61 and 61 through 62. So it actually aired in America, at least before Black Sabbath came out. So that might have been part of the rationale here. It's like, well, audiences are used to Boris Karloff presenting material to them. He's already in it. Let's also get him up on the screen introducing this stuff for us.
Well, you can hear it right in the narration of the trailer. There's the part where it says, like, starring the incomparable Boris Karloff. I guess he is incomparable. But then the other cast members they introduce are the personable Mark Damon, which I thought was hilarious. And then they say, and lush and lovely women, gone unnamed. Come on, dudes.
And we will list some of their names here in a bit. There are some nice performances in here.
Oh, wait. I left off, though. I think the trailer qualifies. It says, so the women in this movie, hey, we got beautiful women, even though one of them is from the netherworld. And I was trying to think back after having seen it, which woman is it talking about? I'm not even sure.
Yeah, there's not really one that's definitely from the netherworld. I mean, a lot of bad supernatural things happen to people and to some women in this motion picture, but I don't think any of them are from the netherworld.
All right. Well, I guess before we talk any more about the actual contents of the movie, we should discuss some of the connections. And obviously, the place to start is with the director, Mario Bava.
Mario Bava, who lived 1914 through 1980. He was the director, but also collaborated on the screenplay. He was the cinematographer. He did matte paintings. He did special effects. This is the legendary Italian director with an unmistakable, obsessive, and phantasmagorical emphasis on visual composition. So you can just look up stills from his movies, and I feel like once you've gotten a taste of how Bava directs and how he composes a shot, a strong still from any of his films is just instantly identifiable. Yeah. It pops with a certain. It's not only the color hue, because I want to stress it's not just a matter of, oh well, Mario Bava used some cool gels here and there. Like, no, it's the complete. It's his use of light and reflections and just the overall composition of every shot in the film.
You ever see one of those animated movies in which there is a magical gem or artifact that glows with magic power?
Mm-hmm.
Mario Bava's movies are like that. There's something about the way they look that the frames from the movie glow with magic power.
Yeah, even when there's less of a reason for it to be glowing so. I was thinking as I was watching this particular picture that it's like an alien civilization that communicates through like synesthesia is trying to speak through the picture. You know, it's like it's that obsessive. Like the colors are clearly of great importance to Bava and all of this.
Though I will say that I totally agree with you. Color is a big part of it, and Bava frequently used sort of expressive, colorful lighting, colored lighting in his movies that is not strictly realistic, meaning it's not reflecting a color you would actually expect to see if this scene were taking place in the real world, but rather colors that sort of reflect feelings coming through and reflect sort of otherworldly, unseen influences. But there are also visual sensibilities he has where that kind of glowing comes through even when it's not in color. Like the example that comes to my mind is his earlier movie, Black Sunday, which is in black and white, and yet it still glows with magic power.
Yeah, that one was from 1960. And it is interesting to imagine this leap from black and white to color for Mario Bava, where they're like, oh, by the way, you can shoot in color now. and you can imagine his excitement at being able to do so. So Bava's background is interesting. He was the son of early Italian cinematographer Eugenio Bava, and Mario trained as a painter, venturing into the world of cinematography as well in the late 30s and the early 40s. But then he eventually started directing as well. It began with some documentary shorts and some uncredited directing work on some various genre films. But then in 1960, that's when Black Sunday came out. He directed that. And that was a very well-regarded and financially successful film. And so Black Sabbath is very much the color follow-up to that, thus the similar release title. Again, kind of coming back to the studio thought here. It's like, well, Black Sunday did pretty good. What can we call the next one? Let's call it Black Sabbath. There we go.
Well, this may be, if that is indeed where the title comes from, I got to say this is the rare case where I would go with the marketing over the original, because once again, the three faces of fear, that may be more literally descriptive of what you're getting with the movie, but it doesn't really have the same punch to it.
Yeah. So Mario Bava directed into the 1970s initially. He retired, then he came back at the behest of a new generation of Italian horror filmmakers, including his own son, director Lamberto Bava. He came back to direct 1975 Shock, and this would prove to be his last feature film as he then died in 1980. But he directed a number of pictures. We're not going to touch on them all, but I thought we might talk about a few of them here. One of them is Planet of the Vampires from 1965.
Rob, can you see the Planet of the Vampires poster right behind me on the wall?
I do. I see that. Yeah, you have it right there up on the wall behind you. So, you know, obviously you're a fan. I finally got around to watching this in full this year. And I have to say it wasn't the most enthralling motion picture when it came to acting and the plot, but such a gorgeous science fiction film to watch, like all of the visuals in it. He does an amazing job and devotes the vast majority of the film's energy and limited budget, I have to add, to create highly effective and colorful alien landscapes, haunted spaceship hallways, also has just some incredible costumes.
Absolutely. So I love Planet of the Vampires, but I usually watch it without sound. It's a movie that I love to put on like in the background while I'm hanging out with friends and listening to music. That's the ideal Planet of the Vampires experience for me, because it's one of those movies. It's a rub the fur movie. It's a movie that's not really about the plot or what happens in it. It is about the visual textures on screen. And that includes everything from, like, you single out the costumes, the spacefarers in the movie are wearing these bizarre black leather space suits with these leather helmets. The lighting and the sets are just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, and it reminds me of a quote that I ran across from Mario Bava, where he said that that horror films are 70% lighting. And I think he has a strong point. I mean, you definitely see that in his work. But we've talked about various examples on the show before where we say things like, oh, well, the monster costume wasn't great. But in this scene, the lighting's amazing, so it absolutely works.
Well, like in The Thing from Another World, yeah. There was if you look at the costume James Arness is wearing, like actually in full lighting, it doesn't look very impressive, but they found a way to make it look good within the narrative by either keeping him in silhouette, backlit, so you can't really see him, so he's just a frame, or just by giving you quick glimpses of him where you can't really understand what's going on. Like they make do in a very effective manner with some limitations in terms of costuming and makeup effects.
Of course, Planet of the Vampires was highly influential. It's sometimes been asked, would we even have Alien and all the films that came after Alien had it not been for Planet of the Vampires? And perhaps not. You know, certainly Bava was a very influential filmmaker.
I mean, one of the big things I think that's called out with respect to Alien is there's a scene in Planet of the Vampires, and Planet of the Vampires came much before. It was 1965, is that right?
Yeah, 65.
There's a scene where the astronauts are on this desolate planet, and they go into a cave and they find a giant alien skeleton stretched out on the surface in there, very much like with the discovery of the derelict spacecraft with the bizarre sort of alien skeleton fused to the chair in Alien.
So ultimately, I think Black Sabbath moves along a lot better. It has better pacing than Planet of the Vampires. But there were still times in this film, as in Planet of the Vampires, where I felt myself disconnected from whatever was happening or supposed to be happening in the plot, but I was still completely drawn in to the visual world presented on the film. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I really appreciated the plot, especially in the word you lack, but through and through, it looks pretty great.
Another Bava film that I'm fond of is Danger Diabolique from 1968. This is a stunning, stylish spy crime yarn starring John Philip Law and Adolfo Celli. People might remember him as the villain from Thunderball, the James Bond film. Terry Thomas is also in it. This was featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000 back in the day, and it is indeed quite ridiculous, but stunning from a visual perspective. Basically, it has that 60s Bond vibe, focused all on comic book crime, and then turned up to about 1,000 Bava style.
I think it was actually the very last episode of the main run of Mystery Science Theater.
That's right, it was.
And it, kind of a strange choice there because, I don't know, I would actually argue that movie's not all that bad. I mean, it's silly in a way that a lot of these movies would be silly, but it's also, I don't know, it's stylishly executed in a very pleasing way.
Oh, I mean, the best films on Mystery Science Theater 3000, and often the best episodes of Mystery Science 3000 revolve around movies that are on their own very watchable.
I know you're thinking about Jack Frost.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a great example. There are multiple examples. I think when I think of my favorite episodes, they're often films that I can and sometimes have watched on my own, you know, without the riffing. Now, Mario Bava was again highly influential, and one of his most famous students was Dario Argento. If you've ever seen Argento's 1977 classic Suspiria, then you've certainly bathed your eyeballs in a very Bava-inspired color scheme.
Yeah, I think it's pretty much unquestionable that Argento picked up where Bava left off with the expressive, colorful lighting, especially for his giallo films.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned Mario's son, Lamberto Bava. He directed such films, went on to direct such films as 1985's Demons, which is excellent, along with a couple of sequels to that. 1984's Devilfish, which is not so excellent. It's basically a Jaws cash-in, one of many. But Lamberto Bava is still making movies. He had a horror movie starring Gerard Depardieu come out this year.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Called Twins, I believe. And I had to check. It has nothing to do with the Arnold movie.
Okay. I got to look that up.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O, allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun.
And I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, let's see. A few other people involved in this film. Marcello Fondato has a screenplay credit, lived 1924 through 2008. Italian screenwriter and director, though I don't really know any of their films. Then there's Alberto Bevilacqua, who lived 1934 through 2013, has a screenplay collaboration credit. Also was a screenwriter on Planet of the Vampires, as well as the Satanic Panic documentary Witchcraft 70, which was narrated by Jack Palance. Now, the film, and certainly this comes out in the trailer, the film claims that the three stories in it are based upon fictions by Chekhov, Tolstoy, and Snyder. And specifically, it's supposed to break down like this. The Drop of Water by Ivan Chekhov, though seemingly connected to a story by Franco Lucentini, and then The Telephone by F.G. Snyder, and then a story not by Leo Tolstoy, as that might lead you to believe, but one by Alexei Tolstoy.
And this would be the one allegedly by Alexei Tolstoy would be the Wordlak, the one that is the one with Boris Karloff in it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Boris Karloff then. Karloff plays Gorka in this, and he's also the host. He lived 1887 through 1969, a bona fide cinema legend, going beyond genre films and horror films and weird films. I mean, he's just one of these icons of cinema.
His horror charisma is unmeasurable in this. It's just it's off the screen.
Yeah, absolutely. Karloff was a British actor, born William Henry Pratt. So, you know, this is very much his stage name, Boris Karloff. Probably is just going to be forever associated with Frankenstein because he played the monster in James Whale's 1932 adaptation of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And then he went on to play the role in other pictures as well, including the excellent 1935 film, The Bride of Frankenstein. Other key horror films from Karloff include 32's The Mummy, 34's The Black Cat, 1940's Black Friday, and much more.
The Black Cat, he actually stars opposite Bela Lugosi, and I think that was the first movie where they had both done that. And I actually haven't seen that one, but I've been meaning to see it for a long time, and apparently it's a lot of fun.
I've heard great things about it. I've heard that it holds up really well, so I've checked that out. Now, Karloff was also famously the non-singing voice of the Grinch in the 1966 animated version from Chuck Jones. The thing about Karloff is that he worked a lot, and even though he's best remembered for his horror roles today, he acted in a wide variety of films. He worked stage and screen. He did television. We already mentioned his horror host gigs. He did a lot.
Yes, and I will say that, I just saw this movie, Black Sabbath, for the first time this week, and I gotta say, this is a new favorite Karloff role for me. We'll discuss the details of the Wurdelac in a little bit, but he plays this wild, hairy, wind-blown patriarch of the Carpathian Mountains who has this demonic energy, and it's so, so powerful. I don't know exactly how he's doing it, but in every line, he feels so at home, truly like a man just hardened by the wilderness who has met something unspeakable upon the mountaintop.
Yeah, he's really able to channel a lot of energy through this role. And it's especially interesting considering that this, again, is late career Karloff. He was 75 or 76 at the time when they filmed this. But he's still incredible and apparently was just always a pleasure to work with. I noticed that Bava singled him out as being just a great guy to work with. Another interesting late Karloff film, I don't know if you've seen this one, Joe. Peter Bogdanovich did a film in 1968 called Targets.
Yes, I have seen this one in which Karloff essentially plays himself. I mean, he plays a character, but the character he plays is named like Doris Orlock or something, and he's an aging horror film star, and he has to go up against like a crazed mass murderer.
Yeah, he ends up confronting an active shooter at a drive-in movie theater. It's a serious film from a young Peter Bogdanovich, who would, of course, go on to direct The Last Picture Show. But he was one of Roger Corman's crew at the time. And for this film, Corman apparently told Bogdanovich that he could make any kind of film he wanted to. There were just two things he needed to make sure of. One, he had to use stock footage from 1963's The Terror, and he had to use Boris Karloff for the 2 days of filming that he still owed Corman. But as it worked out, Karloff loved the script and shot a total of 5 days and refused additional pay. It's a fun story, but also I remember it as being a good movie. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember being impressed with it.
Yeah, a good friend of mine showed me this movie many, many years ago, back before I really was in the Weird House Cinema mode. I think I didn't know who Roger Corman was at the time or anything, but I remember being very enthralled and impressed by it. It's a very stark, scary, realistic kind of movie. Very different than the stylish fantasy horror that Boris Karloff did for most of his career.
Yeah. Well, should we talk about the personable Mark Damon?
Oh, yeah. As he's introduced in the trailer, the personable Mark Damon. I'd say he's a 7 or 8 on the personability scale.
Yeah, he's the closest that we have to like a male hero character in the whole picture. Plays the character, Vladimir Durf?
Durfee. He plays a count or some kind of aristocrat who rides through this village in the Werdulac. Again, I guess we'll discuss more of the plot details of that in a bit. But yeah, he's the closest thing the movie has to sort of a dashing leading man. But even in that story, I don't know if he's exactly that, because he comes off to me as in that story as kind of glib, callow, and confused, not really recognizing the weight of the supernatural power he's up against.
Yeah, he's doomed, this guy. but Mark Damon is interesting, though, because first of all, he was born 1933, still alive as of this recording, and still active. Not as an actor, though, at least not since... I think he retired in the late 70s, or I'm not sure about the late 70s. At some point in the 70s, he retired from acting, and I think did a few little bits here and there, the most recent being in 1997. But he's continued to produce. He's been a producer or an executive producer on 67 pictures and counting, and those titles that he has a credit on include Das Boot, The Neverending Story, Clan of the Cave Bear, 9 1/2 Weeks, Short Circuit, Flight of the Navigator, The Lost Boys, Beastmaster 2, not one, but two different Universal Soldier sequels, and then just a bunch else. So he seems kind of like a big money player in Hollywood.
Maybe he's the producer who came in and demanded that the Lost Boys feature more footage of that saxophone guy.
It could be.
He's like, I want 10 minutes of saxophone guy at least.
Now, acting-wise, Damon was also in Roger Corman's 1960 film House of Usher, which starred Vincent Price. And he has one writing credit, and I found it interesting because it's The Devil's Wedding Night from 1973, on which Joe D'Amato apparently did some uncredited directing. Which is always a great sign. And then Damon plays not one, but two different roles in it. So I looked it up. The poster looks fabulous. It looks very 1970s international horror.
Okay. Featuring the personable George Eastman.
No, there's no George Eastman in this one. Though I will say that Mario Bava directed at least one film that had George Eastman. I can confirm at least one George Eastman project.
Was he in Bay of Blood?
No, he was in, Rabid Dogs? He might have been in Bay of Blood. There's a little Eastman just sprinkled throughout the cinematic universe. All right, let's talk about some of the other players in these three different segments. Now, a lot of these are actors that I'm not really familiar with, and there aren't a lot of titles that they were in that really connected with me. So there's not a lot to really to go through here. Let's start with Susie Anderson, who played what's his character's name? Stenka,
which I no offense to people who actually have that name, but in English that name does sound funny because it sounds like stinker.
Yeah, but this is, I guess, our gorgeous love interest for Damon's character. She was born 1940, Croatian actor who worked during the 1960s. And then there's Rika Deljana, who plays Maria, born in 1934, Greek actor with extremely expressive eyes, or at least Mario Bava was able to shoot her in many scenes where she has really expressive eyes. She's the mother, I believe, in these sequences, and we'll discuss her in a bit. But she had a long career, mostly in Greek cinema and TV.
Now, these are all actors who are in the Werdulac segment. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of other segments of the movie that I guess we've been focusing on less. Do we want to mention some of the actors in these segments before coming back to describe them?
Yeah. So The Telephone, which we'll discuss, has a very small cast. The main character is Rosie, played by Michel Mercier, who is a French actor who worked across multiple decades, born 1939, still alive as of this recording. And then the other major character in that is Mary, played by Lydia Alfonsi, who was born in 1928, also still alive as of this recording. Italian actor who was active well into the 1990s. Her last film was the much acclaimed Life is Beautiful from 1997. And she also appeared in a Steve Reeves Hercules movie in 1958.
So I don't really love The Telephone. We can explain more about our feelings about the individual segments in a bit. The Telephone was definitely my least favorite of the three, but I do really like Lydia Alfonsi in it because she does a very good job of acting creepy.
Yes. All right, and then finally we have the segment, The Drop of Water. I'm going to highlight three different actors in this. There's Jacqueline Peru, who lived 1923 through 2005, plays Helen Chester. So she was a French actor, active from the early 40s through the 1970s. And she's the mother of French actor and director Jean-Pierre Lode, who starred in the 400 Blows.
Hmm.
There's also a character in this that is referred to as the Maid, and it's played by Millie, no last name. Millie, who lived 1905 through 1980, was an Italian singer, actress, and cabaret performer, and apparently something of a pop star of the day.
Hmm. So she's older when this movie was made. So she plays a maid who sort of comes and goes while the main character, played by Jacqueline Peru, is sort of contemplating doing something very ill-advised with respect to the spirit world. But the maid is this kind of mundane influence flitting in and out of the room while this deliberation goes on.
And then finally, there is a neighbor character in this, played by Harriet Medine, who lived 1914 through 2005, an American actor who relocated to Italy with the USO after World War II. She has a pretty great filmography with such titles as Death Race 2000, which is a fun flick. We've talked about that before. The Witches of Eastwick, Schlock, and The Terminator, in which she plays the role of Customer.
Customer where?
I was trying to figure that. I was looking around, you know, short of actually watching Terminator again, I'm not sure. I can't imagine she's in the gun. She's probably in one of those sequences where the Terminator steals a bunch of stuff. Because a lot of the Terminator is just him robbing places so he can have clothes, robbing people and places so he can have clothes and guns.
Or the good guy played by Michael Biehn robbing people.
Yeah, it's a whole sequence. It's just naked dudes committing various crimes and robberies.
Maybe she's walking out of Dick Miller's gun store when Arnold Schwarzenegger's walking in. That's a possibility.
She bought the last plasma rifle.
I was just remembering the part in Terminator that's actually really great when Schwarzenegger rips that guy out of the phone booth. And he doesn't really harm him. It's just a guy on a phone at a phone booth, and the Terminator grabs him by the shoulder and sort of throws him down on the sidewalk so he can use the telephone book.
Yeah, that's pretty good. I mean, why would the Terminator, a machine, use any more force or effort than was necessary in any given task?
Yeah, and you can hear the guy going, "You got a serious attitude problem, man."
Oh, that's good. All right, finally, the music on this film is interesting because, for one thing, you have two different scores. The original score was by Italian jazz band leader Roberto Nicolosi, but American International Pictures replaced his score with one by Les Baxter, who is, of course, the king of exotica and also later did the minimal electronic score for Frogs.
Oh, I remember that now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's I guess it's a memorable score, but it's not an exotica score for Frogs. And this also is not particularly exotica music either. It's certainly not electronic. But I liked it well enough because I could pick up on some Baxter sensibilities in it. I was curious after that because I'm thinking, well, what did it replace? Because we can all think of examples where a score has been replaced by something superior and also cases where a score has been replaced by something maybe less effective for a different audience. So I was listening to the Nicolosi score a bit, and it sounded good as well. I don't know. I liked them both. Maybe Baxter's score is a little bit more dramatic and a little bit more, American. I don't know.
You know, to be honest, I just did not really notice the music much at all, so I don't have much of a comment on it.
Yeah, I don't know if I would have really looked at it that closely had it not been for the Les Baxter connection. Because I do listen to a fair amount of Les Baxter and some bossa nova music, generally very late afternoon. There's a point in the late afternoon where I have to put aside the synth music and the rock music and only exotica or bossa nova will do.
The tiki drink hour.
Yeah, I guess. Even though generally I'm not actually having a tiki drink. I'm generally cooking supper or something. Uh-huh. But it feels right. It feels appropriate.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question is going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun, and I can't wait for you to hear it.
Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
All right, now that we've got all that out of the way, let's get back into the plot of these three horror stories that look fabulous, have great people in them, but ultimately have some interesting ideas as well.
Yeah. So I would say, and you and I may have had some different reactions to these, but I would say that this is an interesting movie to recommend, because while there are three segments, and in my opinion, one of them is astonishingly good, another is quite good, and the third, for me, I found kind of boring and unpleasant. But there's still, I think, some interesting things to talk about with it. And while I think that there were different releases of this movie that put them in different orders, the version I saw starts with the one of the three that was, for me, by far the weakest. So this would be The Telephone.
Ah, yes, The Telephone.
So The Telephone, unlike the other two, is a more realistic story. And the basic premise is pretty simple. It is a psychological thriller about a young woman who is terrorized by a threatening voyeuristic creep who won't stop calling her on the phone. And so I got to say, this is the one I didn't really super enjoy. I like it picked way up with the second one for me when you get to the Wordilac. Mm-hmm. This one kind of has a lot of things I don't really love about Italian horror movies of this period, and not as much of the stuff that I do love.
It's weird because especially from the trailer, you get the impression that they moved the telephone to the opening because they thought it would connect with audiences more. Like maybe they thought audiences didn't want this gothic horror tale. Instead, they would want something that's tied into technology and, you know, feels more cutting edge and dangerous. And yet at the same time, I was reading, it sounds like American International Pictures had like asked them to cut down on some of the what they would have probably thought of as dangerous aspects of the of that opening segment. Supposedly, AIP asked for lesbian romance aspects of the segment to be reduced, and that a supernatural element be sort of implied. But I have to say, at least in the version I watched, I still got the sense that there was some sort of past romantic connection between the two female characters. And I don't remember anything supernatural in this segment. It seemed very based in the real world, though, of course, through that fabulous Bava lens.
Yeah, well, to be honest, now that I think about it, I'm not sure which version of the movie it was that I saw. One thing I've seen comparing them is that I think it was the original Italian version had the more beautiful colors, and that the American release might have had some more muted colors. The version I saw had very beautiful colors, so I'm thinking, and the version I saw, of course, was in Italian with subtitles. It wasn't dubbed.
Yeah, same here, yeah.
I don't know if there is a dubbed version of the movie.
I think there is, but I wasn't able to find, when I rented it, through, I went into Apple, and then I did a 7-day trial of AMC Plus, and that's how I got to watch it. And then when I pulled it up, I was expecting it to be dubbed, but then I saw that it's in Italian with no option for other audio channels, and just with subtitles. But I greatly enjoyed it. But I see examples of people saying that they grew up watching a version in which they hear Boris Karloff's actual voice. So that makes me think there is a dubbed version of it, but this was not it. So with the telephone, I'd say that I guess I kind of like the simplicity of it. It does proceed at a very slow pace, but then it has some very nice twists in it. Mm-hmm. It does not have that gothic feel that that the second segment has. It doesn't have that supernatural sense of otherworldliness. The interiors in this segment are, at first glance, a lot more muted. We spend a lot of time with beautiful women with perfect skin in kind of porcelain-colored garments moving through wedding cake-colored apartments. But even this is very finely crafted and wonderfully punctuated by various colorful items in the background. I don't know if you noticed this or not, Joe, but there'll be everything's this kind of wedding cake porcelain world, and then there'll be one jade statuette on a shelf in the background. And somehow, through that Mario Bava magic, it makes the whole thing pop. Yeah. And I don't even notice that that the plot is moving along so slowly because I'm just admiring the shot.
Or the red telephone.
Red telephone. And then it moves at a slow pace, and then alarming things will happen. There's a great creepy eyes peering in through the window of the apartment. That scene really shook me when I saw it.
Oh, this movie's all about windows.
Yeah, windows, mirrors as well, but certainly windows. And I think you see that in other Bava films as well. Lots of mirrors, people looking through glass. And it makes sense, given his focus on the visual medium.
So I think you sort of raised the idea that this segment is kind of a proto-giallo film. And I wanted to explore that idea a little more. So for people who aren't familiar, giallo films are a particular subgenre of Italian murder mystery thrillers that were popular in the 60s through the 80s. And some of the big name directors of giallo you might recognize are Dario Argento. Usually his supernatural movies like Suspiria are not usually considered giallo films, though they share a lot in common with them stylistically. Usually giallo films are thought to be to have basically realistic causation. They're not about witchcraft and magic and stuff. They're about a murderer who wields a razor blade or something.
The woman with the crystal. Wait, is it The Bird with the Crystal Plumage?
Yeah, Bird with the Crystal Plumage. I mean, Argento made these naturalistic giallo films as well. Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Deep Red, Cat of Nine Tails, Tenebrae. These are all giallo films he did. Mm-hmm. But other big names in Giallo are Sergio Martino, Lucio Fulci, and the director of the movie we're talking about today, Mario Bava. Bava was the director of Blood and Black Lace from 1964, just 1 year after Black Sabbath. And I think Blood and Black Lace, I think, is often considered sort of the archetype of the early Giallo movie, that a lot of Giallo descends from Blood and Black Lace.
I'd love to watch that one someday, because I noticed just today that it has Cameron Mitchell in it.
Oh, that's right. It does. It's been a little while since I've seen it, so I don't remember much in particular about what he does in it. But yeah, anyway, one of the things I noticed is that Blood and Black Lace, I think, has a lot of stylistic similarity with the telephone segment in this movie, except the stylization is turned way up. I'll get back to that in just a minute. But to discuss some of the main characteristics of Giallo movies, they very often feature a murderer who strikes again and again, whose identity is unknown, often masked or with their face hidden in shadow, and they will very often wear a similar outfit, like a long trench coat and black gloves and maybe a hat.
Mm.
In Giallo movies, the murders are usually sort of creative or grisly or of a creepy and squeamish nature, so they're usually not just going to be like the killer shoots somebody with a gun. They might kill somebody with a barber's razor or a needle or something.
Mm-hmm.
Giallo movies also tend to be kind of voyeuristic and sexually charged, often mixing sexuality and violence in an unsettling way. And to varying extents, they tend to be highly stylized. Not all of the directors are like this, but a lot of them are. They'll use these lurid colors and creative cinematography. This is typically the opposite, by the way, of what I would say are the dominant trends in murder mystery films, say, in the United States, which I think are overwhelmingly, they tend toward a gritty, realistic, or muted look with kind of matter-of-fact camera work. It's like they're trying to make it look like real life, whereas Italian Giallo films tend to love these, you know, weird red and purple gel lights and tilted camera angles and shots reflected in a mirror and all kinds of stuff like that.
Yeah, to say nothing of the music.
Yeah, oh yeah. Famously, like the Argento Giallo movies have wonderful scores, usually that, you know, involve Goblin or Argento himself mm-hmm. in some way. There's another strange recurring detail that I notice in a lot of Italian Giallo movies, especially the movies of Dario Argento. But a really common recurring thing is that the protagonist will witness an image or a scene early on in the movie that contains some clue that would serve as the master key to solving the mystery. And this scene or this memory keeps replaying in their mind, but they're unable to recall or figure out what that key detail is until the final resolution. So I think about the museum murder scene in The Bird with the Crystal Plumage, or the face in the hallway in Deep Red, and so forth.
Interesting.
So looking back through this lens, like, is the telephone sort of a short form proto Giallo? In a way, I think it kind of is. It has some of that same naturalistic terror mystery sensibility. It has a clue detail in the room, except the protagonist, I don't know if she sees it. I don't think she does, but I'm thinking about the zoom in on the eyes in the window looking through the blinds, which is very creepy. It does have that creepy, voyeuristic, and sexually charged sensibility, which I do not always enjoy in these movies, to be honest, though it is not as stylized as a lot of later Giallo, which I would have enjoyed more. I mean, I kind of wish Bava had played up his visual sense more in this segment. With Blood and Black Lace that comes later, I almost wonder if Bava sort of cross-fertilized different parts of his own creative process after Black Sabbath. Like, if he started thinking, okay, what if I did a story that was more like this, set in the modern world, as sort of a naturalistic mystery terror, like The Telephone, but I filmed it with that otherworldly visual sensibility that I used in The Werdelac, where everything glows with magic power.
Yeah, interesting. Well, let's talk about the Werdelac or the Werdelac here.
Oh, yeah. Are we going to wuh or are we going to vuh?
What should they use in the film? I thought I was hearing a vuh, but we could go either way. I don't think the monsters mind.
I'm going to go vuh. Let's assume that's authentic and then try it. We could be wrong. but yeah, how about the Werdelac? So the Werdelac, I think picking up after the first segment, which I didn't especially love, the Werdelac, I think, is extraordinary. It's this Carpathian Gothic tale where these auroras of weird color just drip from the crags. Like I said earlier, it's a new, you know, it goes on my list of favorite Boris Karloff roles. He plays this shaggy, wild, purple Kurt Vonnegut type guy. You notice he looks like Vonnegut
sometimes?
Yeah,
he does.
And this whole segment is just full of awesome Slavic twang and this menace of the hills. Absolutely wonderful.
The visual world that Bava creates in here that maybe isn't noticeable right at first, but then just really leaches in. He creates this dark domain that is occupied entirely by fog and ruins and desolate farmhouses, multiple just absolutely creepy scenes and sequences. I absolutely loved it. In fact, if you have never watched this film and you're going to pick it up, I think you should watch it in its entirety, but if you need to, you can go ahead and skip the telephone and go straight to this, straight to the Verdelak.
So to do a very quick plot description on it, I don't want to spoil everything about it, but It begins with the personable Mark Damon, who plays an aristocrat, who he's a count or something. I don't recall exactly what he is, but he's riding through the mountains and he's clearly in a rural rustic area, and he comes across a corpse just lying there by a riverside. And so this is a corpse that's had its head removed and it has been stabbed through the heart with a very distinctive dagger. And so he's like, oh, I guess I got to do something about this. So he picks up the corpse and he carries it with him to a nearby village. Or I don't know if it's even a village. It might just sort of be the compound of one family, you know, under the heading of this one patriarch in his house.
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah, he comes to this house out in the mountains and he goes in to meet the people who live there. And he says, hey, I found this corpse. And immediately they know what's going on. They're like, oh, yes, that is our father's dagger you found through the heart of this corpse. And that's because our father has gone out to kill the Werdelak. Or, well, let's see. Do I remember? Did they establish that the being he was trying to kill they knew was a Werdelak, or did they just think it was a local highwayman and murderer that their father was going out to kill? There was sort of blurring of the lines there.
Yeah, there was both, because clearly this region is dealing with a serious Werdelak problem, but then the Werdelak has also been identified as a particular individual who is also a notorious highwayman.
Right. So from this, they conclude, oh, okay, our father succeeded in his quest. He went out into the mountains to find this criminal, this highwayman, and kill him. And here's his body, but where's Pop? You know, you would think he would have come back by now. And so the family members here, they include the two sons and the daughter of Boris Karloff's character, and then the oldest son's wife and child as well. And so they tell the story, well, our father went out into the mountains to hunt down this brigand and possible supernatural menace, the Werdelak, and kill him. And then he warned us, if I come back after 5 days, don't let me in, because then I'm going to be a Werdelak probably by that time.
Yes.
And there's a great plot device of ambiguity, because when does Boris Karloff show up? Right at the toll of midnight on the fifth day. So he's like coming in right on the line, and you don't know one way or another.
Yeah, though, I think one of the messages of this whole sequence here is that if Grandpa says he might be a Werdelak, just go ahead and assume he's a Werdelak, because it's going to be the safer assumption.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. It is 2024, and we're going to get through this together, folks. My campaign promise to all of you here on Next Question, it's going to be a good time the whole time, we hope. I have some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring Kris Jenner, who's got some words of wisdom for me on being a good grandmother, or in her case, a good lovey.
You know, you start thinking of what you want your grandmother name to be. Like, are they going to call me grandma like I called my grandmother? So I got to choose my name, which is now Lovey.
I'll also be joined by Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, to name a few. So come on in and take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood.
I loved it. Your energy and joy.
I'm squeezing every minute I can for you out of this season of Next Question.
Last question, I promise. You have to go. I have to go. But it's been so fun,
and I can't wait for you to hear it. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there. I'm Dr. Maya Shunker, and I'm a scientist who studies human behavior. Many of us have experienced a moment in our lives that changes everything. A moment that instantly divides our life into a before and an after. On my podcast, A Slight Change of Plans, I talk to people about navigating these very moments.
The last couple of years has been the hardest season of our marriage, for sure. I'm surprised our marriage survived it. I think we both are. I think we both were barely holding on. Nothing compares to how hard this is.
Their stories are full of candor, awe, and hard-won wisdom. And you'll hear from scientists who teach us how we can be more resilient in the face of change.
True behavior change is really identity change. Every action you take is a vote for the type of person you wish to become.
Listen to A Slight Change of Plans on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Some of you might be wondering, is a Vertilock really a thing? Well, I did look it up, and according to folklorist Carol Rose, who I often refer to with my monster queries here, it's actually more werewolf than vampire, but in the Slavic tradition, the two concepts are kind of interlocked. One version, at least, was that when a werewolf is killed, it transforms into a vampire that could then reassume the form of a wolf, and Vertilock apparently means wolf's hair. But in this movie, what we see is essentially a take on the vampire legend with a fun twist. Well, I don't know if it's fun, depending on which end of it. If you're just enjoying the horror of it, I guess it's fun. If you're a character in the story, not so fun. And that is that the monster, when it comes back, when it takes on the form of those it has killed, it's going to be drawn most to those that it loved in life. Those are going to be the ones that it focuses all of its monstrous intensity on.
This is a vampire as betrayer of trust. Not just a vampire that needs blood, anybody's blood, just got to have a meal of blood. This is a vampire that specifically comes for its loved ones.
Yeah, which I was thinking about this a little bit because, again, the pacing of the film, I think, invites contemplation and also an enjoyment of the visuals. But, like, what is – wonder what this sequence and what this – this legend is like, what does it say about like love and bereavement? You know, the twisted way that our strongest positive emotions can become negative emotions. Mm-hmm. And then ultimately, is this story advising us not to love anybody because that alone would protect us from monsters?
Well, that's a good question. And then I want to take that a step further. A lot of horror movies have very weakly earned love stories where, you know, the characters fall in love with each other. You don't really see a lot of reason for them to fall. You know, you don't see a lot of like scenes of chemistry of them, you know, finding things they like about one another. It just kind of happens because the script says so. This story, The Vertilock, has a couple of characters who seem to fall in love with each other very quickly and in this sort of weakly justified way. But I wonder if that's not intentional in this case. It's saying something about like falling, you know, loving too easily and there being a kind of danger in that.
Yeah. Yeah. The character that Damon plays, you do kind of feel that, right? It's like what do you do? You're in love. You just met her, and you're so in love with her that you are going to risk incurring the wrath of her, you know, undead transformed family. It seems foolish, and it seems like as a fool in a short horror work, you are going to be punished for this foolishness.
Well, and it also says something about family, I think, because, again, this will be a minor spoiler. I don't think it'll ruin your enjoyment of this segment, you can enjoy even if you read the whole plot ahead of time. But warning to spoil the ending. So I think it is basically the fact that Mark Damon's character, he comes in, he very quickly and maybe unjustifiedly falls in love with Stenka, and then Stenka apparently sort of reciprocates. You know, she likes him too. And you get the impression that it's interesting that at first – Mark Damon's character is not really threatened by the Vertilock because he's not a member of the family and it only wants its own family. But it's once she reciprocates his feelings and they fall in love with each other that then he is also subject to the threat of having his blood drunk, you know, of being attacked by the supernatural creature. It's once there is a bond of love between him and her that now he is fair game for this monster.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's probably something telling in there about attachments. But at the same time, it's like he clearly is loving strongly and loving deeply, albeit very briefly. So maybe it's all worth it. It's worth all the anguish and death because the love was that strong. It seems to have there is a sort of a bittersweet romantic element to the way this wraps up.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, overall, everything else we've said about the Vertilock, the atmosphere is just amazing in it. There are such wonderful scenes of looking out the window and maybe seeing Boris Karloff in his purple Kurt Vonnegut with the shaggy furry hood. Oh, God, it's just so, so good.
Oh, the sequence with the child crying for the mother. Ooh, that's super creepy. That one gave me the shivers.
Yeah.
Another great thing about this sequence is it has a great decapitated head. So at this point in my life, in my film-going life, and I imagine you're much the same, Joe, I've seen a vast spectrum of decapitated head effects, ranging from just the laughable to the, you know, at times shockingly realistic. It's interesting to think of like realistic and non-realistic decapitated head effects because I think most all of us don't have anything to judge it against, you know, and I think that's ultimately a good thing. We can't really, we don't look at a decapitated head and go like, wait a minute, that's not what a decapitated head looks like. I saw a decapitated head this morning.
The Get Out My Faces of Death videos.
Yeah. But at any rate, there's I love even a hokey beheading effect. But this film has not one but two beautifully disturbing corpse head sculpts. And these were actually created by Mario Bava's father, Eugenio Bava, which I thought was interesting. They're both absolutely beautiful and, of course, terrifying.
Well, speaking of beautiful and terrifying corpses, we got to also mention the third segment in this movie, A Drop of Water, which for me, the Vertilock is the standout, but A Drop of Water I thought was also very, very good. And it has, I got to say, one of the creepiest movie corpses I have ever seen, along with a wonderful twist and some really great set and lighting choices.
Yeah, this one again, the telephone, things are a little maybe more subdued, but still pretty brilliant, but subdued for Bava. Vertilok, colorful and wonderful and out there. This one, too, is just absolutely touching your eyeballs with its color scheme.
Specifically, the thing that stuck with me most about the drop of water, there were two things. One is that it has this marvelous creepy corpse design, but the other was that the main character in this plays a nurse who lives in an apartment that has this oval-shaped window, and outside the window is a constantly, gently pulsing green light. And I don't know what exactly that was supposed to be in terms of realism. I think there's a quick shot from outside at first where it's raining out, and maybe it's supposed to be some kind of rotating sign or something. I'm not quite positive, but the effect within the apartment is these pulses of green that are, I just love it. I love it. I want to live in that.
Yeah, that window is absolutely amazing. It's like a horizontal oval shape, and it has this this kind of like iron latticework cross in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. I have never seen anything quite like it. And yeah, and then this pulsating light. So this was very much a sequence in the film where I think I was a little uncertain about like what was supposed to be happening and you know, what's supposed to be pulling me along character wise or plot wise, but I could not look away from that window. And it was reminding me of something too. And I realized it was reminding me of a scene from the 1997 sci-fi film Event Horizon. Which I know you've seen as well, Joe. There's a sequence where there is a corpse floating aboard the Event Horizon spaceship, and it's floating in front of this cross-shaped window that has kind of bluish-greenish space lights pulsating behind it.
And you think it was influenced by this short?
I wonder if it was, because for starters, Event Horizon is a film that is not shy about taking inspiration from other films. No. I love it, but like you see the DNA of these other films in it. It's all about that. And so, I wonder if the cinematographer on Event Horizon, an individual by the name of Adrian Biddle, who worked on Aliens and Judge Dredd and various other films, I wonder if this particular scene is kind of a nod to Bava, because it feels Bava-esque. It feels like it might be a slight tip of the hat.
Event Horizon could be an interesting movie to come back to, because I find it to be a very very strange and an unusual combination of very inspired and very hack.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, I loved Event Horizon when it came out, and then when I rewatched it several years ago, there were still things I absolutely loved about it, but some things were I kind of sighed and groaned at. But still, yeah. It has a place in my heart.
Well, I guess you could say, much like The Telephone, the plot of A Drop of Water is pretty straightforward. So a nurse is called out to the apartment of a woman that she has been taking care of who has just died. And this woman apparently was involved in the occult. I think they say that she died during a seance.
Yeah.
And so then the nurse must go into the room where her dead body is laying and help prepare the corpse. But when she goes into the room, she notices that the cadaver here has a splendid, very expensive looking piece of jewelry on it, a beautiful ring that has maybe a sapphire in it or something. And she looks at it and is like, well, is this just, you know, is this ring going to go to waste? Is this expensive piece of jewelry just going to go into a coffin and then rot in the ground? I could grab that thing and take it with me. And then you get the sense that the nurse is sort of living in poverty, like that she could use a big cash in at the pawn shop.
She needs to buy some curtains to put over that creepy window.
Yeah, exactly.
How does she sleep at night?
So she grabs the ring. But of course, I don't know if you want to grab the ring off the corpse of a lady who just died while being involved with the occult.
Right.
And so the rest of this segment has some wonderful scenes of the haunting of a guilty conscience. And then there's also an excellent twist at the ending of this segment, too.
Yeah, I've kind of downplayed the plotting of Bava films, I guess, in general here. But yeah, I think all three sequences have some fun plot twists and some fun developments. You don't really know where everything's going to go. Things don't follow a clearly defined path, which is rather pleasurable.
I agree. So, I mean, as we were saying at the beginning, horror anthologies are often kind of, you know, your different segments are going to be of different quality. But I would say after, I guess if we're wrapping up here at the end, I really enjoyed 2 out of 3 segments. But if you only check out one of the segments from this movie, definitely I would say the Vertilac, the Vertilac, the Vertilac.
Yeah, come for the Vertilac, stay for the drop of water, and find something to love in the telephone. Oh, but then also we have to come back to our host here, because one of the fun things about the American International Pictures release of it is that we added this intro bit from Boris Karloff, and apparently they filmed some segments of Boris Karloff that would have gone between each of the segments, but they didn't use those. So we just go from segment 1 to segment 2 to segment 3, but then when segment 3 ends, we come back to Boris Karloff, and it, weirdly enough, he's like in his he seems to be in costume from the Vertilac. He's riding a horse, but he has this kind of almost Crypt Keeper-esque, jovial atmosphere about him. And I can't even remember what he's telling us, because as he's saying, wrapping up for everybody, we pan out and we have this kind of holy mountain moment where we pan out and we see that it's a set. We see a cameraman. We see people holding up these bushes that are supposed to be, rushing past him as he rides this horse. And we see that the horse itself is just a saddle on like a fake horse rump that's being put into motion. Wow. And it's such a weird ending. I was thinking about it. It's like, why did we punctuate this film, Black Sabbath, this trio of horrifying tales, each with a dark ending? And I was wondering if it was because they thought, well, it's 1963, audiences don't want to go home feeling depressed. They need to go home with a smile on their face. So we need this, we need a fun ending. We need Boris Karloff reminding them that it's all just a movie. It's none of this is real. It was weird.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what motivated that ending. Maybe like you're saying, send them home with a smile on their face. But I loved it. Rachel and I both really appreciated the pulling back to see, especially the best part of it for me was the people running around with the potted plants to move them in front of the camera to simulate the horse actually traveling through stuff in the foreground.
Yeah, it's something. I guess thinking to other horror host environments, like you need to do one of two things. Either you have the horror host punctuate the terror or the cerebral nature of it, like the voiceover for The Outer Limits is all about really driving home the serious message of the piece. Or if you're watching Twilight Zone, it's all about reminding you of how dark and mysterious things really are. But the Crypt Keeper, he just comes back to make several punny jokes. And so, what Karloff is doing here is very much in the Crypt Keeper mode of lightening the mood, I feel. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close this one out, but we recommend everybody, this is the Halloween season. So if you need a nice gothic atmospheric film to watch, check out Black Sabbath. This is also a fine one, just to play visually in the background. If you just want some really strong visuals, this one's good to go. Black Sabbath is widely available for digital rental or purchase. Again, I watched it on Apple TV by doing a free preview of AMC Plus, but it's also widely available on disc, including Kino Classics. They have a Blu-ray of it, though I guess we'll leave the research to you, figuring out what version you're about to purchase or rent, because we both watched the Italian language version subtitled, but I think there is a dubbed version as well. I don't know what the availability on that is. I can't speak to it personally.
I can't comment on that, but I do think there are different versions that have different levels of sort of color saturation and all that. Mm-hmm. Try to find one with the really intense colors.
Yeah, that's the most important thing. Yeah, the colors speak volumes. The colors speak in ways that the dialogue and the subtitles are going to pale in comparison to. All right, well, we'll be back next week with another, I think, thoroughly Halloween-y selection. But in the meantime, you can listen to Weird House Cinema every Friday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We're primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Artifact on Wednesday, Listener Mail on Monday. But on Fridays, we take a little time to just discuss a weird film like Black Sabbath.
Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast hosts Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.